Welcome back to the program. The debate about abortion rights in this country has consumed our politics for decades. It seems that each time the freedom to choose seems like a settled issue, the nation becomes even more divided. Why has this issue had such resiliency? Why can't we value the due process and privacy that the Supreme Court so clearly has upheld? And why is this still even an issue of debate among younger women? We're going to spend some time today looking back through all of this, through the lens of a woman who's been at the forefront of the movement, whose tireless efforts have put herself in danger while fighting so hard for the rights of other women. It is my pleasure to be joined this morning by our guest, Merle Hoffman. She's an award-winning journalist, activist, and women's health care pioneer. In 1971, she founded Choices, one of the first abortion centers, which has become one of the nation's largest women's medical facilities. She's the founder of the New York Pro-Choice Coalition and a co-founder of the National Abortion Federation. It is my pleasure to welcome Merle Hoffman here to talk about her new memoir, Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Women Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. Merle Hoffman, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you today.
It's great to have you. Why is it, and I don't mean this in a flip way, why are we still debating this issue so many years later? I mean, I'm sure you must ask yourself that question sometimes.
I've stopped asking the question because I'm so busy in the debate and the response and the activity to move the whole issue forward and settle it, if ever. Probably will never be settled. There is a consistent, relentless opposition to having women have the power and the responsibility and the ability and the accessibility and the availability to exercise reproductive choice. They are not only violently and vociferously opposed to abortion, but in many cases to birth control. And this is an ongoing struggle. I mean, I really don't see that this will be settled in my lifetime. And if, you know, one is just looking at the television every now and then, you could see that the Republican candidates are jumping over themselves like kangaroos to see who can be more anti-choice than the next.
I want to come back to the point you just made a moment ago with respect to birth control in general, because it did seem for a time that that issue had subsided, and yet now that very issue is at the forefront once again.
Right, right. Funds are cut. There was the demand not to allow Plan B to be sold to young women under 17, and Sebelius actually overrode the FDA on that. So it's not only the Republicans. In many, many, many schools, the only birth control sex education that young girls get is abstinence. There are a lot of young women who don't even have access to the knowledge about what to do to prevent an unintended pregnancy. So it's quite dangerous, because this is not only about abortion, it's about birth control, it's about women in any way being sexual and deciding how to be sexual, and it comes down basically to an issue of power.
One of the things that we've seen in the air, and it's not a perfect analogy, but I want to get your take on it. One of the things we've seen in the realm of gay rights, for example, is that the younger generation has kind of led the way. As more and more young people have accepted diversity, it has changed the political landscape. Why haven't young women accomplished the same thing with respect to this debate over birth control and abortion?
Well, I think that, you know, there is a very strong current of religiosity and traditional thinking when it comes to abortion. And don't think that it is that gay rights are so really accepted. I think there are a lot of areas where there are still young kids who suffer terribly from bullying and even, you know, suicide. So, you know, yes, there is gay marriage, and the movement has made enormous forward march. But with abortion, you're talking about, for a lot of people, murder. And, you know, then you bring in God's will and the idea that a lot of these anti-choice people see themselves as, you know, God's warriors in this transcendent battle to not only save babies, but to save America, because God's judgment is on this country because there's so much blood spilled in the case of abortion. So, you know, it goes deeper than the homosexuality. And I do wish, I really do wish that the gay rights movement would be stronger in coalition with the pro-choice movement. You know, I formed the first New York pro-choice coalition when Operation Rescue came to town in New York, and our clinics were being invaded, and it was a struggle. It was a struggle to get civil rights people and to get gay rights people involved, and I think that that's also very necessary if we're going to continue to proactively press our agenda of chosen parenthood.
What, if any, impact has the international community and globalization had on the abortion movement in this country?
Very little. I mean, actually, the WHO just put out a report that there are more illegal abortions now. I mean, this is after all of this time. I would say the impact of globalization is the impact economically. I mean, I just did a study and a press conference in Washington where I talked about abortionomics and how the recession and the economic situation that so many people find themselves in is actually driving up the abortion rate. But it's, you know, women get into this Kafkaesque situation. They can't afford to have a child. They want to access birth control to prevent getting pregnant. It's difficult in many cases to get the birth control, so they become pregnant when they don't want to be. They either get late-term abortions, have a child that they can't feed or afford to bring up, or go for some lousy semi-legal procedure. So the globalization, you have to look at the impact totally in terms of the economy and what it's doing to the middle and lower middle classes, and particularly to women. And what's happening is that they're unable to make learned and accurate for themselves choices about how to plan families, and they find themselves pregnant very often when they don't want to be.
One of the things that you talk about, it has certainly been part of this struggle, both the political and the religious, is the degree to which it is rooted in the power relationship between
right.
men and women. Talk about that.
Well, yes, and you know, a lot of people will say, well, oh, it's because there are a lot of religious concepts against abortion, and that's true, but I see misogyny dressed in religion. It's religion's like the cloak, the everyday wear, that this basic misogyny, which is a distrust of women, a desire to ensure that their means of production or their means of reproduction are controlled by the state, i.e., usually men or the government, or the church, or the venues of state and religious power. And when a woman decides to terminate a pregnancy, she's saying, I am taking responsibility for this life growing inside me. I am deciding that it should not come to term. And that really flies in the face of a very fundamental paradigm that many people, many men, many women also traditionally think of, with God at the top and the state and man and the father and the family and then mother. So it really is, in my mind, a primal power struggle.
What do you make of this whole personhood debate and the degree to which it not only goes to the heart of what we're talking about, but in many ways is kind of anti-science and anti-intellectual?
Again, I use the word Kafkaesque, you know, because it is so bizarre, because what they're really talking about is making a sperm and an egg a constitutional person from the moment of conception. And that would have as much constitutional standing as you or I or any other born person. And, you know, that's why I say, well, sign it up for the military. Let's have, you know, more taxes. It's really over the top. But yet, it had a chance of passing. Fortunately, when it was up for vote by the voters in Mississippi, they realized that, hey, this is going to affect fertility treatments. This is going to affect birth control. This is really too out there. But it was voted down in Mississippi, but they're rising up in other areas of the country. You know, they, in a sense, they do live in a state of denial. And the science is denied, the fact-based study of how things work or causality is denied, you know. That's why I call my study abortionomics. And my thinking is, if you really want to reduce the abortion rate, have access and education for people to get birth control to prevent unwanted pregnancies in the first place. But they don't see it that way. They're also against birth control. So, you know, people say to me, well, how can they think that way? How can they? And at this point, I have to be honest, I don't spend a moment of my time trying to analyze how it is they come up with the way they come up thinking. All I know is that I have to oppose it.
When you
with
look
facts and with reality and with truth.
Right. When you look back, as you do, as you take this journey in intimate wars, at the 40-plus year history of the movement, are there moments that you wish had gone differently in terms of what you and your colleagues in the movement had done? Are there turning points, tipping points that might have led it in a different direction?
Well, the one I always go back to is the moment in 1976 that politicized me, when Henry Hyde, and the comment he made was, if we can't save all the babies, we can at least save the babies of the poor, and he cut off Medicaid funding for poor women. And these were the women that I was working with, that I saw every day, and I thought it was horribly discriminatory. And I think at that point in time, there should have been a massive outcry from the entire pro-choice movement, and saying, you know, if you take rights away from the poorest, the youngest, the most vulnerable and disenfranchised of us, you take it away from me. But that didn't happen. So, you know, I think that within those years, the pro-choice movement really felt, you know, especially after 73. I mean, 76 was only 3 years after 73, and there was this feeling on the pro-choice side that, wow, we've got this Supreme Court decision, they're never going to make abortion illegal anymore, and there was sort of a collective putting their feet up on the desk and saying, now we can relax a little bit, but you can't relax in this war because it's constantly relentless.
What about the periods where there seemed to be at least less opposition, periods in the mid-80s and also around 2005, 2006, where opposition seemed to have lessened and then it took off again?
Yeah, well, you know, it ebbs and flows because this is a long-term struggle. You're not going to have a hot war all the time. There are different types. You know, they had guerrilla tactics, you know, during one decade. Then, you know, depending on who was in the White House, usually when Democrats were in the White House, there was quite more violence because the anti-choice movement felt even more disenfranchised. So that's when they had the murders. And then then it became, they changed their tactics to talking about, you know, it's a feminist for choice, that no feminist would ever kill, you know, their own child, particularly if the fetus is female. So it's a constantly shape-shifting attack, which is, you know, the way it should be. It's very creative. You know, it has altered itself to the demographics. It's altered itself to, you know, what people are thinking, to the technology. And the pro-choice movement has to, you know, run even faster to oppose it in all of its configurations. It's like, you know what, I think of it as like the Hydra, you know. You have to slay this Hydra, multi-headed thing. And, you know, you cut one head off and another one comes up. You cut another one and they, you know, they come at you in another way. And the root of it is the power struggle of the misogyny. And I don't know how long it'll take to get to the root.
In many ways, it seemed that things got worse during the course of the 90s, even when there was a Democratic administration.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. They do get worse because the movement really feels more, even more disenfranchised. When Reagan was in office, it was quieter in a sense. You know, there wasn't that much violence because they had a spokesperson in the bully pulpit, you know, and the president would come out and he would talk to them on their, you know, yearly Right to Life march, and there was more of a feeling of support, you know, from institutional reality or from the government. But when it's a Democratic president, they feel more disenfranchised. Actually, there was a firebomb in Pensacola in one of the clinics just 2 weeks ago. So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if we started to see more of it.
What impact does that kind of extremism have on the pro-choice movement?
The impact is to dig in even deeper. I mean, it's a terrible, terrible thing, you know, to lose a physician like this. George Tiller, who was shot in the head in his church, was a friend of mine. And, you know, to realize that this man had put himself so often on the line and helped so many women, and, you know, he's just shot down in cold blood. It's horrifying. But, you know, you go on. I've always said that I judge my actions politically and in the world by the strength of the opposition to it. And not to say that the anti-choice movement, you know, approves of any of this. I mean, although I think some of their language can set the context for it. But, you know, it does set the room, the stage for extremism, for people who are feeling disenfranchised and tie in and tap into this movement where they empathize with the fetus who they see is being torn, ripped, killed inside these women's wombs, and these women don't even know what they're doing. And really, if you would sit them down and tell them that it's really growing and it has fingers and toes, they would never have an abortion, and it's only these abortionists, these dirty, bloody, horrible people that are forcing them to do it. And all of that is a fantasy, you know. It's all a fantasy. But they believe it.
Looking forward, are there ways that you and your colleagues see to somehow change the rhetoric, change the debate, to try new things in this debate?
Well, we are trying. I think I mentioned building coalitions. I think that's very strong. We're talking about a term of reproductive justice, not only reproductive rights and reproductive health, because it's not only the right to terminate a pregnancy, but we want to have a society that women can choose to bring children into this world and parent them in the way they want and have the supports that they need, so many women wouldn't have to make this decision. So, you know, we are talking about a broader concept of reproductive justice, and then also to talk about, you know, one out of three American women have had or will have abortions by the time they're 45 years old. One out of three. That is an extraordinarily high number. And if these women and their families and the people who are involved with them would own that decision and just even begin to talk about it and say, yes, I had to make that decision, and I did, that would be extremely helpful, you know, because it's sort of this common shared secret. It's this big, big elephant in the country, you know, elephant. I mean, what is that, the Republicans? It's a big animal in the middle of the country that nobody...
Right. Talk a little bit about young women in the movement today that don't know the history that you write about in Intimate Wars and how dealing with
it. Young women in the history of the movement, and it's really all of young people in the country. I mean, we're not a historically based society. We're not people who reflect, who think critically. I mean, it's as if reality is created anew every moment. I always tease and say I feel that I'm in this movie Groundhog Day, you know, where I wake up and it's the same day and I hear the same arguments like 1980. But there is an attempt. There are a lot of young people who are very active, particularly online. There's a virtual march this week called the Silver Ribbon Campaign. There are campus activism. It's coming. It's coming, you know, because they have to do it in their own way. And I think that we will see a lot more soon. I think we'll see a lot more soon. But the lack of historical knowledge in the pro-choice movement is not only a reflection of our movement, but it's a reflection of the way people are in society here.
And does it make a difference in terms of the movement, do you think?
Absolutely. Oh, it's critical. It's critical because we are facing the same enemy, the same ideology. I mean, it's very helpful to know what was done before and if it worked, how it worked, and how it can be used at this point in time and reflect back. I mean, it's an entire tactical, strategic discussion. I mean, I feel like a general most of the time, and if I'm making decisions, you know, either to attack or defend or, you know, flank the enemy, I've got to know, well, did it work there? How many troops did they have? What's going on? I mean, you have to know. You can't just work in a vacuum. And I think what's happened a lot of the time is that's what happens. You know, people just react because there's an attack and they go on the defensive and you know, without sometimes enough strategic and analytic thought. And the anti-choice movement has kept the pro-choice movement on the defensive for many years, and it's time for us to start becoming far more proactive, and discussions are happening around that.
And how do you see that happening? How do you see that proactive ability playing out?
Well, with as I say, to talk in more coalition, to change the paradigm, to do more intergenerational work. I mean, that will play out as the issue morphs and changes, and as we have to either respond or proactively go out with another message. You know, so I can't give you a global response, but you know, it's experiential in a sense.
And what is the legal and political state of play now, as you see it?
Well, you know, the abortion is legal nationally by Roe v. Wade, that Supreme Court decision. But with all the states passing so many obstacles and amendments to restrict women's availability and accessibility, it is becoming impossible for a lot of women. The battle for abortion rights is really very focused on the states right now. Last year, there were about, 110 anti-choice amendments brought up, things like having to have counseling by the doctor, which is basically a kind of propaganda, having to have sonograms, you know, changing doctors' offices to become regulated ambulatory surgery centers for a first trimester abortion, which is swatting, a fly hairs with an elephant. An elephant's swatting a fly. So all of these things, and you know, 90% of counties in America have no abortion provider at all. So all of this results in abortion being impossible for a lot of women. Not illegal, but impossible.
And finally, talk a little bit about what keeps your efforts going every day in spite of how long you've been fighting this battle.
Right.
As you say, it's a little like Groundhog Day.
Well, you know, I mean, I was 25 years old when the first patient came to the facility that I was starting to have an abortion, and she was white, and she was married, and she had one child, and she was terrified, of course, and she was pregnant, and she didn't want to be. She couldn't be. She couldn't afford it. And I was in graduate school for psychology, and abortion had just been legalized, and, you know, I nobody knew anything. But I talked to her, and not only did I talk to her, I stayed with her throughout her abortion, and I held her hand, I touched her hair, and I comforted her. And it was catalytic for me. It was that moment where I was with that woman holding her hand, and for the thousands of women that have come after her, it's as if I'm channeling them, and I feel a responsibility, an enormous responsibility to these women, to the patients, and to the movement, and that's what keeps me going.
Merrill Hoffman, her book is Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Women Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. Merrill, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.